Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. There is no topic subject to greater debate in the United States than the nation's schools, and one of the most commonly made points is that the schools are not as good as they used to be. Is that true? What were American schools like a century ago? How have they changed? That's the subject of this week's interview with Diane Ravitch, former member of the U.S. Department of Education. But before we get to that, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. In 1858, two candidates for an Illinois senatorial seat, Republican Abraham Lincoln and Democrat Stephen Douglas, engaged in the first of what came to be known as the Lincoln-Douglas debates. Extension of slavery into new territories of the West was the hot issue, and political compromises of the past 40 years had failed to resolve the matter. The Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854, a bill that Stephen Douglas endorsed, introduced the doctrine of popular sovereignty, let the people decide, and the result was widespread bloodshed in Kansas. Then in 1857, the United States Supreme Court ruled that the federal government had no power to outlaw slavery anywhere in the territories. The nation was on the verge of being torn apart. Both Lincoln and Douglas knew that they were addressing an issue of grave national importance when they engaged in their first debate on August 21st. Douglas tried to convince those present that Lincoln was a dangerous radical who advocated racial equality and disruption of the Union, while Lincoln emphasized the wickedness of slavery and attacked Douglas's endorsement of popular sovereignty. On August 27th, Lincoln challenged Douglas to reconsider the repercussions of his doctrine of popular sovereignty. Douglas responded with his Freeport Doctrine, which would allow settlers in new territories to refuse to adopt laws necessary to protect slavery, thereby discouraging slave owners from bringing slaves into that territory. The Freeport Doctrine only further divided the nation. Although Douglas won the Illinois election in 1858, he lost to Lincoln in the presidential election of 1860. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, the Vatican's role during World War II remains obscured, despite historians' attempts to probe the facts pertaining to Pope Pius XII's wartime actions. This is due in large part to the Vatican's failure to fully cooperate with the panel of historians, which it appointed to conduct the investigation. The panel's activities have been suspended because the Holy See has not released all of its wartime archives. So far, historians have concluded that Pius XII left diplomatic channels with Hitler's Germany open despite reports of atrocities pouring into the Vatican, but gaps remain in 11 volumes of documents that record the correspondence between Pope Pius XII, bishops, and governments. That information remains hidden in archives that the Vatican declares is not accessible for technical reasons. Veterans of the Cold War have been in an uproar since last June when the Strategic Air Command Museum near Ashland, Nebraska changed its name to the Strategic Air and Space Museum. Many of them helped the museum by donating time and money when the SAC Museum was struggling at its former location near the Offutt Air Force Base in Bellevue. They say the museum director's decision to make the name change was a slap in the face and a threat to the memory of Cold War veterans' sacrifices. The museum's director and board chairman defended the change as an attempt to reach out to new, younger, post-Cold War audiences. This is Talking History. President Bush has a new plan for the nation's schools, but then so have many presidents in American history. Indeed, as our guest today writes, the past century has been awash with proposals to reform public education with dubious results. Talking History's Fred Nielsen talks with our guest, Diane Ravitch.
The author or editor of almost a score of books, Diane Ravitch is one of America's leading historians of education and an important contributor to contemporary policy debates. She has been a professor at Teachers College, Columbia University, and at New York University. From 1991 to 1993, she served in the U.S. Department of Education. She currently holds the Brown Chair in Education Studies at the Brookings Institution. Her latest book is Left Back, A Century of Failed School Reforms. Diane Ravitch, welcome.
Hi, nice to be here, Fred.
What were American schools like a century ago?
The elementary schools were pretty much the same everywhere, and there was close to universal attendance for, if only for a few months of the year. Almost all kids went to elementary schools across the country. And they focused on reading, writing, arithmetic, and almost, let's say, half of them used the McGuffey series, so they had pretty good literature, and the other half used books that looked very much like the McGuffey series. The high schools, on the other hand, did not have universal attendance. In fact, only about 1 out of 20 American 17-year-olds went to any graduated high school or went to high school. So it was a much more selective population, and there was really only one track in high school. Everybody took an academic curriculum, and whether they were the farmer's son or the factory worker's son or the banker's son, they all studied Latin and history, literature, and math and science. Foreign languages were very important. Everyone took a foreign language, and most kids took Latin.
The early 20th century, the progressive era, saw the rise of experts in many fields, including education. How did the educational experts change American schools?
Well, the main educational experts who came to prominence in the beginning of the century, and there was no such thing as an educational expert in the 19th century, but in the beginning of the 20th century, we had really a bull market in educational experts, and so particularly psychologists and sociologists stepped forward, people like Edward Thorndike and David Snedden and G. Stanley Hall, and they said, you know, all this emphasis on literature and history was not right because so many kids weren't going to college that it was a waste of time to teach them these academic things. So what the experts pushed for and the way they changed American schools was that they encouraged tracking of kids, dividing up kids into vocational tracks. They, under the leadership, especially of the sociologists and psychologists, the schools introduced IQ testing and divided kids up based on certainly their IQ, but that was a reflection of what their parents' occupation was, what their social status was, and also what their future occupation was. So you had, after the experts got their oar in the water, in effect, you had a lot of tracking and division of kids rather than kids studying a common curriculum.
The result of this, you suggest, is that the reforms, whatever their intention, was more elitist than democratic.
Well, there was a lot of talk about democracy, but what the experts meant by democracy is not what most of us today would mean. When they said that it's more democratic to put the farmer's son in an agricultural curriculum and to put girls in a household arts curriculum, that would serve the needs of a democratic society. And they talked a lot about meeting the needs of children, but actually what they were, I think they were using rhetoric that today we would recognize as being elitist, because they were saying, well, you know, the college prep curriculum, which is what all kids used to have in both in the common schools and in high school, this kind of academic curriculum is somehow, that itself is elitist, so we should reserve that only for the few who are bound for college. So there became this very strange inversion of rhetoric in which the democratic talk was used to divide kids up and to preserve the good stuff only for the children of either very privileged families or children who had a high IQ or children who, for one reason or another, just weren't placed in a vocational track.
John Dewey is probably the central figure in progressive education in the 20th century. By no means does he escape criticism in your book. You give him some hard times, in fact, but often it seemed to me as I was reading your book that he comes off better than some of his disciples, whom you often charge with misunderstanding or misapplying or twisting Dewey's ideas. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, John Dewey is a very equivocal figure, in my view, in American history. My mentor, Lawrence Kremen, who is a great historian of education, said it's in one of his books that when you read Dewey, it's like looking into a witch's mirror, that you see what you want to see and you take out of it what you want to take out of it. And people read Dewey and say, oh, he's a great champion of democracy. Others read Dewey and say he undermined the traditional schooling. In a sense, both are right. He was a champion of democracy. But Dewey, I think what's most troublesome for me about Dewey is that he became a secular saint. It became impossible, and it's still almost impossible in many precincts today to criticize Dewey. He's been criticized by people who haven't read him, But people who do read them and try to criticize them are considered, lumped with like the radical right. How dare you question John Dewey? And the one thing that John Dewey was very consistent about was that he believed in that everything was open to question. And so I think it's in the spirit of Dewey that one should today say, let's look at his role very closely. Let's criticize his ideas. And I think where I'm most critical of him is his sins of omission. That is, he could have stepped up and probably stopped the craze for IQ testing had he inserted himself into the debate. He was already in the 1920s a sainted figure in American public education, and amongst the psychologists, he was considered, almost like an American pope. He could do no wrong. So had he stepped in and said, look, guys, you're taking this too far. We really can't make all these predictions about kids based on this IQ test, it would have done a lot to change a fad that turned out to be very injurious. Also, I'm quite critical of Dewey also because whenever he offered a choice between traditional and progressive education, he always loaded the dice. He really he pretended not to take a position, but he was very much an advocate of progressivism. And in some of his books, he was actually allied himself with very free-form schools where there were no rules and no structure and no curriculum. And there was a famous book that he wrote in 1916 called Schools of Tomorrow, where several of the schools that he lauded were, in fact, these kind of anti-MAME schools where kids did whatever they wanted to do. And I think that as we see this working itself through the public school system and through private schools, it really doesn't benefit kids to be in a school where they can do whatever they want to do. Most kids need teachers.
Clearly, one of the things that changes as the reforms of the progressives take hold across the country is the academic curriculum. How does that change throughout the 20th century?
Well, the academic curriculum changed in many ways. For one thing, a lot of parts of it got lost. It used to be in American schools that one of the things that all kids took, or almost virtually all children took, was a foreign language. Foreign language studies suffered grievously because there was such a push to say it wasn't useful. And so many of the experts, especially the sociologists and economists, were saying, why should American kids learn a foreign language? Why should they learn Latin? What good is Latin? What good is French? What good is German? So, by putting this criterion of usefulness on everything, they drove foreign languages down, but they drove the enrollments down, and they did this quite intentionally. And I show this in example after example where they just said this is not a good investment of our public resources. And so they reduced the number of kids taking foreign languages. They also drove ancient history out of the curriculum. Ancient history used to be a staple. Medieval history used to be a staple. And American history got submerged into the social studies. And if you today look at and say, well, what are the two fields in U.S. education where there are the most people teaching who haven't actually studied what they're teaching? And the two fields are physics and history. We have a dearth of history teachers, and it is a kind of a ridiculous situation. But the social studies de-emphasized history teaching. And in English, what we've lost has been a very, very strong literature curriculum. I mean, our kids should be reading the great works from our culture and from other cultures, and in most cases, they're just reading stories about kids today and things that were written in the last 10 or 15 years by people who work for publishing houses. So I think those would be the main changes. And the other very important change is the very large number of kids, in fact, the majority of kids, who are diverted away from the academic curriculum and into a general curriculum. The numbers that I've seen show that almost half the enrollment in American high schools was in a general track as late as 1980. That means that they were neither in an academic nor a vocational program. So those have been big changes, and that is really to reduce the expectations. And we've seen an effort over the past 15 years or so to reverse that, and I think that's a good thing.
One of the things that I learned from your book was that change in the curriculum came from above, not below. In fact, as you point out repeatedly, there are more children and parents who want the kids to take Latin than there are experts who want them to.
Well, that's a sad thing, and I keep running into people who say, where are we going to find Latin teachers? And the problem, a couple of generations ago was, what are we going to do with all these Latin teachers now that no one's taking it anymore? So I think our country did a job of getting rid of them, and now when there is at least some demand, they're not there.
One of the heroes of your book is William Bagley, not as famous as John Dewey by any means. Who was he?
William Bagley was a professor of education first, and he worked in different places. He was in Illinois. He was out in the West for a while, and he eventually came to Teachers College and spent most of his career at Teachers College. Bagley was the great anti-progressive. He was also a very deeply humane man who had himself been a teacher and a principal. So he knew the classroom very well. He didn't speak from theory. He spoke from his own experience. He wrote a number of very important books defending the academic curriculum and defending the very important ideal that all children should have access to a high-quality curriculum. And he, in 1914, made the argument for a liberal education for all children and debated one of the leading advocates of vocational education. And so people at that time, in 1914, began to think, well, Bagley is some sort of conservative because he wants all kids to have a liberal education. Then in the 1920s, Bagley was the outstanding, in fact, probably almost the only critic within the education profession of IQ testing. And he wrote a book against IQ testing called Determinism in Education, where he showed that the IQ test that had been administered during World War I didn't prove what the IQ tester said. The IQ tester said, well, IQ is innate, it's inherent, the schools had no effect, it doesn't matter what happens, what experiences people have. And Bagley said, no, where the educational opportunity was greatest, that's where the IQ scores were the greatest. And those were the young men going into World War I who had been in states where there were the best-funded school systems actually had the highest IQs. And he pointed out that there were northern blacks who went into the Army in World War I who had higher IQs than some southern whites. So Bagley was a very important figure, and because of his opposition to vocationalism in the schools, because of his opposition to tracking and streaming, and because of his opposition to IQ testing, he was considered very conservative, and he was completely on the outs with the dominant group. And the dominant group endorsed tracking, streaming, dividing kids up, different kinds of educational opportunity. And I have written about Bagley both in this book and other places as one of the forgotten heroes of American education.
You write in your conclusion that if there's a lesson to be learned from the river of ink that was spilled in the education disputes of the 20th century, it's that anything in education that's labeled a movement should be avoided like the plague. Why is that?
Well, I think that what we need in education, and at one point even John Dewey said this, is we don't need traditional schools or progressive schools. We need good schools. We need to have common sense in education and not get caught up in enthusiasm. The story of the 20th century has been a story of one movement following another. Almost all of those movements have come from the same direction. They've all been different forms of progressivism that say that, in effect, gee, we have a new movement that says that teachers don't matter. We have another movement that says kids can teach themselves. We have another movement called whole language that says that children don't need to be instructed in the English language. And, you know, movement after movement to de-emphasize teaching. And when it comes right down to it, there are certain fundamentals in education. And one of them is that children need good teachers, and most children need to be instructed. They can't figure things out all by themselves. They're children, and that's the role of adults, is to provide good instruction.
Well, it strikes me sometimes that we expect children to act their age, but we should also expect parents to act their age too.
Well,
and that means
there are a lot of things, that children don't know, and I've had the experience of talking to ninth graders and saying, well, you know, do you know what the Cold War was? And they'd say, no, I don't have any idea. Now, the only way they're going to find out about the 20th century is if they're taught. They're not going to figure it out all by themselves. They're not even going to think to ask.
You have only a minute or so left. What, in your view, should be the goal of public education? Or to put the question in a slightly different way, why do schools matter?
Schools are the place where adults make young people more intelligent, more capable of taking care of themselves, more capable of thinking for themselves. And they also, in the course of this, teach our democratic civic culture. And if they forget to do either of those two things, then I think our society would be in grave trouble.
Thank you much, Dr. Ravitch.
Well, thank you, Fred. It's nice to talk to you.
I've been visiting with Diane Ravitch, author of Left Back, A Century of Failed School Reforms.
Yakko?
Yes, Miss Flamille?
I want you to multiply 47 times 83.
7 times 3 is 21, which, as you know, is just 2 tens plus 1, and so we put the 1 right here, and we carry the 2, 1 left to the top of the tens place right next door, and we put it on top of the number 4, which is really 4 tens that we multiply times 3 in the ones place, and that's why we now have 12, which we add to the 2 that we carry to get 14.
Upon the urging of Senator Robert Byrd, Congress recently adopted a measure which will provide the nation's schools with $50 million, perhaps even $100 million next year, to improve the teaching of American history. What does that mean for the nation's professional historians? Will it provide opportunities or make more demands of them? Here to offer her answer to those questions is Arnita Jones, Executive Director of the American Historical Association.
Historians today find themselves in an unusual position. Their field, for many years an ideologically charged battleground, now enjoys bipartisan congressional support. Last summer, Senator Robert C. Byrd, ranking minority member of the Senate Appropriations Committee, sat down at his desk on the Senate floor and wrote out an amendment to the 2001 appropriations bill for the U.S. Department of Education. His intention was simple, to include $50 million to develop, implement, and strengthen programs to teach American history. The theme resonated with other members of Congress, and the amendment eventually became law. More good news came this spring when Senator Byrd proposed another $100 million for the program in 2002. Naturally, historians are enthusiastic about these developments, but the language attached to the 2001 appropriations bill creates a challenge for us because it specifies that all grants be made to local education agencies, which means school districts. There were no provisions for projects to be initiated or financed through colleges, universities, historical societies, or other such institutions. That should serve as a warning that college and university historians haven't made enough of a case for what they have to offer the nation's schools. Yet we know that many current teachers will retire in the coming decade, and that increasing enrollments in many school districts throughout the country will require an influx of newly trained teachers. College and university historians need to take responsibility for training these teachers. One of the best ways for historians to demonstrate their willingness to assume this responsibility will be to respond to the Department of Education's call for proposals for the Teaching American History Grant Program. Beyond that, we also need to consider what models for partnerships already exist, and there are many, and figure out how we can develop more. That will involve seeking out colleagues in schools of education and school districts, and it will require being sensitive to the needs of pre-collegiate teachers and the pressures under which they work. And it will also mean that college and university history departments have to think hard about how such work by their faculty members fits into the professional reward system. We are lucky the current Congress sees the need for history teachers. It's time to make the most of that opportunity. Let's make sure that colleges and universities are prepared to help.
You've been listening to Arnita Jones, Executive Director of the American Historical Association, and this is Talking History. Earlier in the show, we mentioned the Lincoln-Douglas debates of 1858. For our site of the week, Talking History's Cindy Workman tells you about Lincoln's Illinois home and an annual event at his home where you can learn more about President Lincoln.
The Lincoln Home National Historic Site has much to offer visitors. At the center of the park is the two-story home of Abraham Lincoln that was built in 1839. The home has been restored to its appearance in 1860 and reveals Lincoln as husband, father, politician, and president-elect. The house stands in the middle of a four-block historic neighborhood, which the National Park Service is restoring so that the neighborhood will look like it did when Lincoln lived there. For the past 16 years, the Lincoln Home National Historic Site has been part of a colloquium involving local and national historians, students, and history buffs. The September 15th colloquium is focusing on Lincoln's America and the Coming War. Reservations are needed to attend the event. The Lincoln Home site is open year-round.
Finally, turning to our segment on coming attractions, the University of San Francisco has organized an exhibit marking the 50th anniversary of the signing of the peace treaty with Japan. The treaty officially ended hostilities of the Second World War. Although the Japanese government and military forces formally surrendered to the Allied powers on September 2, 1945, no formal treaty was signed. Instead, the United States occupied Japan and carried out a program of demilitarization and democratization. Discussion of the contents of the peace treaty began in 1947, but it took almost 4 years of negotiations to arrive at an agreement satisfactory to all parties involved. The purpose of the exhibit is to let people know what actually happened in the peace conference and to spotlight individuals and groups involved in the signing of the treaty. On the actual anniversary date, September 19th, the university will host a public forum on the U.S.-Japan peace treaty, which will be free and open to the public. The exhibit will remain open until October 31st. For further information on the exhibit and forum, contact the University of San Francisco. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Talking History is a production of Creighton University and the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Creighton, visit the university's website at creighton.edu. Information on the Organization of American Historians is available at oah.org. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.